This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today, in this portion of the program, we take a look at our ideas about living and dying, and we'll talk about living well. Our guest is Robert Thurman, a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism. He says to live well is to engage in the world fully. As a Tibetan Buddhist, he believes the lives we lead have an impact on the world of the present, the future, and the past. Robert Thurman's latest book is Infinite Life, Seven Virtues for Living Well. It follows the publication of Inner Revolution, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Real Happiness. Robert Thurman was ordained a monk by the Dalai Lama in 1965. He was the first Western Tibetan Buddhist monk. He is a college professor who holds the first endowed chair in Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies in America at Columbia University. He's also the co-founder and president of Tibet House New York, an organization dedicated to preserving Tibetan civilization. Professor Thurman's new book, Infinite Life, Seven Virtues for Living Well, is published by Riverhead Books. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I invite your questions and comments. Here are the numbers. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Professor Thurman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Celeste. Nice to be here.
What led you to Buddhism?
I'm still finding my way there, actually, Celeste.
Yeah.
I'm not really, I don't think of it as a place in which you can sort of enter and hide. When I was younger, I went to Harvard and different good schools, and I was looking at studying a lot of philosophy. And I just wasn't satisfied with Western philosophy. I loved Kant, and I liked Nietzsche, and I liked Wittgenstein, and a few people like that, and Plato, of course. But I just thought there was something still missing for me, and at a certain point, I started reading an Indian philosophy, which I really liked. And then when I narrowed that down, I got into Buddhist philosophy, and I liked that even more. And then I went to India, and I met the Tibetan people and started studying with them and learned their language. And that really gave me sort of a lifetime's worth of exploration.
Yeah.
And that relates to Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, but it isn't really sort of a narrow religious thing. It's more of like a different way of exploring the world.
Okay. And I have to kind of watch myself now here a little bit because, you know, as you said, it's not exactly a path and it's not exactly a destination. It's a way of exploring the entire world.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, I see Buddhism as more like a science, an inner science, a science that takes the mind seriously and looks into the world at the same time as looking at how we are presupposing the world. And therefore, it's a way of exploring reality, really, rather than simply adopting a certain belief system.
Yeah. Well, in the book, you refer to Buddhism as a psychology. Maybe it would be useful here to talk about how it is similar, how it is different from Western psychology.
Right. Well, one way it's different is that it's about 2,400 years older, since in India, at the same time as you had the pre-Socratics and some of the Greek thinkers, you know, who developed geometry and mathematics, etc. Although Plato was interested in the mind and the soul, but the majority of them were interested in the natural sciences. In India, they thought the most important natural science was the science of the mind, how the mind worked, because they reasoned that in a particular situation in life, the most important factor determining whether you enjoy or whether you're miserable is your own inner predisposition. As we know, we can be in very humble circumstances and be quite happy, or we can be in a perfect, wonderful place and be in a bad mood and have a miserable time. And therefore, the mind kind of dominates. I mean, the outer circumstances are not unimportant, but the mind does dominate our experience. And therefore, they figured you should learn how to control your mind if you want to have a happy life. And they put their big effort into that, you know, like 2,400 years ahead of Freud and Jung and any of the psychologists, they really got into that. And they systematized their observations and they developed methods to change our minds to make them sort of better instruments for living. And that's a wonderful treasury, the things that they have in their culture, the Buddhist cultures. And that's what I've really been interested in from the beginning, rather than just sort of adopting a kind of exotic religion.
Yeah. You say often Buddhist teachings are misunderstood. For example, when we think of Buddhism, one of the first things that may come to mind is all life is suffering.
That's right.
What is the Buddhist teaching about suffering?
That's right. Well, Buddha got a bad rap for that statement. But the thing is that it, because it's taken out of context, he made a set of four statements as his main framework of his teaching, the most important of which was the third, which is that it is possible to become completely free from all suffering, namely the statement of nirvana, you know, that the human birthright and destiny and potential is to become completely free of suffering and to attain nirvana, as they call it. And then, once that was his main discovery, he then said, well, if you persist in being unenlightened and not understanding your world and misunderstanding yourself, then you're going to suffer because you'll be frustrated all the time. So what people did is they took that first statement, which is something like the diagnosis of the unsatisfying life, as his main pronouncement about life. But that was not so. In other words, what his statement is, the enlightened life is blissful, happy. The unenlightened life is going to be suffering by comparison, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what does he mean by unenlightenment? It's very important to quickly explain that so as to make it something that's not so mysterious. What unenlightenment is, Celeste, is like, for example, my feeling that me, Bob Thurman, I'm the most important person around. And, you know, I'm the only real thing that I know of, that I'm sure that I'm really real. I don't know about everybody else or everything else. And when I have that exaggerated egocentric worldview, I'm going to be frustrated because, guess what? The world is not going to agree with me. You know, everyone else is going to consider themselves more important than me, and the world certainly is going to overtake me. You know, I'm going to get sick, grow old, die. I'm not going to have full satisfaction, whatever I try. So as long as I'm operating with a distorted belief system and a distorted ego system of making myself the center of the universe and having the universe always knock me off course, then I'm going to be frustrated. And the solution to that is to fully understand my true relational nature with the whole universe, that the universe and I are not that different. We are somewhat different in a relative sense, and we are somewhat the same in that we're totally interconnected. And once I gain a real visceral insight into that, and I see the error of my old false habit of self-importance, then I can harmoniously relate to the world and to other beings and actually make them happy and be happy myself, and that's actually called nirvana.
Hmm. Let's talk with a listener. We've got a caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon. Caller on line one, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering, I know, you know, people that are suffering, and they strongly believe in Western religions, and there's no reason for me to dissuade them of that, but I'm wondering if they can retain their beliefs and still benefit from Buddhist psychology without too much dissonance.
Yes, I certainly think so, although, Celeste, maybe the engineer could turn up the volume. I had a very hard time hearing that, and your
okay.
voice also has gotten quite faint.
Okay.
I believe I heard your question right. What was your name?
We don't usually give our names on this program.
Oh, you don't give names. Oh, okay,
but everyone knows it anyway.
Well, the young lady's question was about whether there was, you know, whether the Buddhist psychology could be compatible with some of the Western religious views. And I certainly think so. In my Infinite Life book, I take quite an effort to show that those interpretations of the Western monotheistic traditions that really open up to the infinity of God and don't narrowly cling to a particular exact version this way and that way and place themselves in a limited framework by sort of absolutizing a particular version of it, but actually open up to the infinity and, in a way, the unknowability and inconceivability of God. When the Western monotheistic interpretation is like that, then the infinite life view, what I call the infinite life view, is very, very accessible, and then the wonders and the benefits of Buddhist psychology can definitely be used without having to be a Buddhist. In fact, that's a major point that I make. I'm not writing this book for Buddhists only. I'm writing it for people, whether religious or humanist, who want to improve their worldview and want to have a more satisfying life and develop their mind better and get rid of anger and greed and confusion and become clear and become patient and become loving and generous. And this is irrespective of one's religious ideology. But there is no doubt that certain type of religious ideology, which makes, sort of, I'm the only important one because I have this religion. People who don't have my religion are no good. They're going to all go to hell. They are all crazy and something like that. I am the only one who knows what it is. Well, that, I think, that kind of interpretation of making a kind of dogma or an idol out of one's own religion, I think, is not going to be too compatible. But, you know, Eastern religious believers can also do that. It isn't just a Western thing. There are some versions of Eastern religions, even of Buddhism, that make it a narrow thing where someone thinks, well, I'm so superior and so great because I have such and such a religion. And in a way, they're using the religion to reinforce the distorted ego sense that causes their suffering. And so this kind of thing, Buddhist psychology would hope to help people relieve themselves from. But Buddhist psychology should be used by everyone who wants to improve their open and broaden their awareness, irrespective of their religious belief. And in fact, the Dalai Lama, who's quite popular nowadays in the West and in the East, is always saying, please don't become Buddhist. And all the other world religions, he says, please, let's not try to convert each other anymore. You know, religious missionary activity is too dangerous in this modern world. It will lead to conflict and to violence, as we're seeing all over the world now between religions. And therefore, we should just be very firm in our own belief, very delightful, very pleased with our own religious conviction, but not try to impose it on others. And so Buddhist psychology is very strongly in agreement with that.
Well, I have another question I don't really know how to express, but, sometimes we feel that people are suffering, maybe people in our families or close friends, and we may desire to help them. But it seems that sometimes in thinking, you know, you need help and I can help you, or I'd like to help you even if I can't help you perhaps, that we are separating ourselves from others.
Yes.
So do we need to simply try to find peace in ourselves and see if...
Well, I think it's a combined process. You know, for example, you can't really find peace in yourself if you're in the midst of a very turbulent or violent situation, unless you're somebody who's like a super, super advanced type of person. In other words, like on a battlefield or in the middle of a big quarrel or struggle, it's very hard to find peace in oneself. So finding that peace in oneself sometimes means making peace with the world, at least moderating the level of struggle. And so the two kind of go together. On the other hand, some difficult cases of people who are really bent on suffering or quite angry types or quite troubled types, you have to develop yourself a certain degree in order to be able to help them. And in fact, as every good mother knows, sometimes with a child, if they're having a tantrum, the mother has to have the strength to kind of laugh or turn away and not get into the tantrum. And so the child then realizes it's not getting anything from the tantrum, and then it will stop. And so sometimes you need a certain inner strength of your own and an inner joyfulness and happiness that is not disturbed by other people being disturbed in order to get them to shift their habits, so to speak. So it's always a complex thing in each situation, and it involves developing yourself, of course, but sometimes that will involve doing things for others and trying to help them. And sometimes, of course, helping others means being quite firm with them, a little tough with them. You know, there is that expression, tough love. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone is addicted to something, for example, or if they're just completely accustomed to a certain bad habit, sometimes it's important to oppose them and not just to enable their bad habit. So it's really complicated, you know, my friend, but you can't always give a rule that it will be absolutely this way or that way. But you can always think carefully about it, and there are many resources you can use. Western psychology, I don't mean it's not a good thing. Western psychology has a lot of useful methods and strategies for management of family conflicts and all sorts of things. But the Buddhist thing has a lot of reinforcing from a deep inner spiritual place that tends to help the Western stuff, which tends to be very secular, you know, in outlook, and to be afraid of spirituality even.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, let's talk with another listener, caller on line 4.
Oh, good.
In Loda. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Professor Thurman.
Hi.
What an honor to listen to you. I am a student of yours. I have the Jewel of Tibet, the tapes.
How nice. Good.
I have the Make the World We Want and the Millennium, your books, everything that I can study that you have done. I am just delighted that WILL has invited you.
I'm very honored they did. Thank you.
It's so wonderful to hear Dharma in the air. lovely. My question is, being a Christian before finding the Dharma, sometimes I've been studying for 2 years. I do not have the opportunity to go to a center. Tibetan is what calls me, the Dharma that calls to me. So I'm doing it on my own, but the Christianity keeps pulling me.
Oh, good.
Is it possible?
That's good.
Is it possible to practice? Because eventually I would like to take the teachings, the meditation, the...
Yes. Oh, yes, I think it's very possible to fit these things together. As I said before, His Holiness the Dalai Lama is always saying to people, if you're originally Christian or Jewish or Muslim or secular or humanist, then please don't think that just switching over because you're interested in some meditation or something about Buddhism and when you initially encounter it, please don't think that anything can be solved by switching over. And in fact, sometimes it causes psychological and other problems, certainly with one's family, sometimes with one's community and neighborhood. And so the switching, the denominational switching, is not the important thing at all. In fact, can be even counterproductive. The key thing is to try to learn whatever we can from wherever, from whichever tradition, about compassion, about love, about kindness, about calmness and inner peace, about wisdom, and seeing through the pretensions of egocentric behavior and egotism. And this is what all the great religious teachers teach. Jesus certainly taught, I believe, the infinite life. He was a complete demonstrator of the infinite life, and he showed them that he was beyond even their worst, nastiest things they tried to do to him, because he was living in that infinite life framework, and he was, of course, a highly developed divine being. And not everyone, of course, can do what he does, but the point is that there are beneficial methods of opening your awareness and developing your kindness and developing your clear thinking that can be used in relation to any of the traditions. And, of course, it is true that in the older days, people sort of simplistically all felt that an important part of their tradition was saying that it is the best and there's nothing else is any good, you know, which is a kind of cultural egotism, really. In other words, I happen to be born in such a place and that's what the local religion is, so it must be the best. It's like an extension of my own sense of myself is the best. And actually, God or Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Muhammad, these people, these beings, they laugh at the petty human beings who say, claim that they're the best and they have the best and all of this. And really, they don't approve of that. That's what in Christianity, in the Abrahamic religions, the injunction against idolatry has to do with making your own image of the divine into something more important than the divine itself. And you can do that in your mind as well as with a cow, you know, a sculpture of a cow. And so, by all means, you should not feel any conflict between your Christianity and your Buddhism or your Buddhist practice. You should integrate it probably within the Christian larger worldview, because that's how you were born and brought up. And you should, but on the other hand, you should try to avoid any very narrow, prejudicial, and, you know, divisive interpretation of any of the religions. You know, we should not interpret our own religions in ways that divide us from others. That's not a good idea. In other words, we should learn to do, as the Dalai Lama says, to say, well, this is best for me, but I don't presume to impose it on you. And I think I can use things that you've taught me or that others have discovered and use that in relation to my Christianity. For example, at the time when Jesus lived in Palestine, it's most likely that everyone believed the world was flat, you know. And nowadays, Christians can easily believe the world is round. And it, because they see the, you know, they fly around it on the United Airlines, you know, and they can not be disturbed with their Christianity because they've shifted a little bit their reality view. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So similarly, you can adopt different methods and psychological things, and you can broaden your worldview without abandoning your personal faith, which it would probably be better for you to do it that way.
Yes, well, I thank you, but like I said, the Tibetan way calls me, so that eventually I would slowly ease my way into. But as I know that
well, that's possible. I mean, I became a Buddhist myself in my impetuous youth, but I was never really very Christian anyway. Although I was brought up as a Presbyterian, but my family were very relaxed about it, and we were sort of secular humanists. And in a way, I think most Americans, even though they have the Christian idea about heaven or hell in the future, they pretty much live in terms of this life and what they can get out of this life, and that makes them pretty secular, actually, even though they may nominally be Christian. So in my case, I did, but, you know, I can appreciate the fact that in many ways, in relation to my culture and my family, it might have been easier on everybody if I had just remained a Christian and then learned, tried to become a better person by using methods from all the world religions, if I had been able to do that. But I was not. It was just my karma, as we say, you know. So each one is individual, and we do have religious freedom in the world, and we should maintain that religious freedom. We should not allow religion to take over the state ever in any country. And so each one will have their own way, you know. That's the way it should
yes,
be.
Well, I just would like to end by saying that when I started, I was a little bit afraid, and I purchased many, many books. But then when I read yours, it seemed that it was clear, I could understand, and then I just stayed with your material.
Oh, that's good. I'm so happy to hear that.
So
nice to know you did all that writing for some purpose.
I tell you, my life is just great, wonderful, and my family has seen results, and I just want to invite everybody, read Robert Thurman.
Oh, that's very sweet of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Robert Thurman is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He was the first Western Tibetan Buddhist monk. He's a college professor who holds the first endowed chair in Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies in America at Columbia University. Also the co-founder and president of Tibet House New York, an organization dedicated to preserving Tibetan civilization. His latest book is Infinite Life, Seven Virtues for Living Well. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At the beginning of Infinite Life, you write of beginninglessness. What is beginninglessness, and what is its...
Beginninglessness is...
What is its connection to infinite life?
Well, of course, if life is infinite, then that means it has always been happening
mm-hmm.
in the past, as well as that it will always continue in the future. It wouldn't really make sense if life came from nothing in some moment and there was no past, and then yet it's extended infinitely in the future. That would be illogical and unnecessarily irrational. Indeed, one of my main arguments that I elaborate at length in there is that we do misuse the word nothing, which actually refers to exactly nothing, and therefore it cannot be the source of anything, nor can it be the destination of anything. Nothing, no thing can become nothing. It just, each something becomes another something, you know, the law of conservation of energy. And similarly, nothing can come out of nothing. So everything always came out of something previously. So beginninglessness is a concept that at first, when I first encountered Buddhist philosophy, I was very mystified by, because we always hear about in the beginning this and in the beginning mm-hmm. that, you know, in our own culture. But in those works, they always talk about from the beginningless, they say, or from beginninglessness. And what that, and when I understood that, which I give a little anecdote about that in the book, you're right, as you say, it was very liberating for me. It was kind of like solving the chicken and egg problem by just letting them go on forever backwards, chickens and eggs, and not worrying about it, you know, because it's not really that important. What it really is important is where we are now and how we got to be where we are now and how can we make a better place for ourselves and for our loved ones in the endless future. And So beginninglessness was a big breakthrough for me, and I think it is a very interesting idea. Now, some Western theologians might say, well, we don't believe in that. We believe that there was a beginning. But I can debate with them in a way in saying that, well, yes, they believe there's a beginning of the ordinary world created by God, but they certainly don't believe that God had a beginning. They certainly think that God is infinite and therefore beginningless. And since God was there from the beginningless, in a way, is always eternally there, then whatever is created comes from him, actually. And the expression of made it out of nothing simply means that since God is infinite, there's no room anywhere for anything other than God. And the world is just a manifestation of God out of compassion for other beings, which he also is creating. So the idea of a first beginning is a kind of childlike idea, I think, where human beings, since they can't remember past a certain point when they think back, they think, well, nothing existed before then, before I was aware, and that's kind of childish. So the infinite life view, on the other hand, you know, when I say infinite life, I'm not saying that somehow I'm selling infinite life to people, like they should believe what I'm saying and that there's infinite life. What I'm saying is that the reality is that everyone is part of infinite life, everyone has an infinite life, and so everyone should try to wake up to what they have and deal with it responsibly. The thing that, of course, I'm most out to liberate people from, if possible, you know, just intellectually, is the idea that at the end of their existence, when their brain stops, they become nothing. And that, therefore, the consequences of what they do, think, or the consequences of their being are ultimately meaningless because they just go, they merge into sort of non-existence, into oblivion. And that, to me, is a very crippling and bad worldview. And luckily, the religions don't have that view. The religions have the view that, you know, heaven or hell type of view, although some people find that scary, and I'm glad they do, because maybe they'll behave a bit better. But although the idea, Buddhists don't agree, we can't agree that there's an idea of eternal damnation, you know, that God would create somebody and then just have them suffer forever. We don't believe we would not attribute that kind of behavior to an omnipotent and omnicompassionate being. No way. The Buddhist view of the ultimate being is that compassion is the strong force of the universe, the creator of the universe. Wisdom is the creator, not some sort of sadistic thing of creating somebody and then sending them to eternal damnation. We think that's silly. On the other hand, beings can create a very bad situation for themselves and others and suffer in a very hellish way, and we would hope that they would wake up and not do that. And a major way of waking up and not doing that is to be responsible to your relationships in the world. And the best way of doing that is to realize that you are infinitely connected with everything. And so everything you do has infinite consequences. You come from infinite past where you have grown to a certain point where you now are a great, wonderful human being. And you can become a magnificent, enlightened being, a bodhisattva or a Buddha or even a divine being if you continue to evolve. Or an angel, you know, or something, and that's what you should therefore really put an effort in your precious human life to do that.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Oh, good.
Caller, caller there on line one? No, I think we've lost that caller.
Dear.
Maybe
sorry, I'm too long-winded. I apologize.
Well, they'll call back, I think. Let's invite them to call us back.
You know, they can't stop, you know, when they start to talk.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, this idea of beginninglessness, does it tie into selflessness?
Excuse me, just a second.
The idea of beginninglessness.
The idea of what?
The idea of beginninglessness.
Yes.
Does it tie into the goal of selflessness?
Yes, I think so. Because selflessness means that it doesn't mean that you don't exist or you don't have a self. This is very important. Selflessness means that in an absolute sense, yourself, you know, your celeste self, my Bob self, that's not my absolute essence. You know, that's my personal, temporary, relative identity. And the mistake that I make that causes my suffering is when I think that my temporary, relative identity is some sort of absolute identity. Because, of course, since I'm a relative creature, everything knocks into me. I grow older. I have difficulties. My mood changes inside and outside, and my circumstances change. And if I'm trying to always cling to one image of myself, it makes a tremendous inner stress. And so selflessness means only that that sense of a rigid, fixed, independent inner self is a delusion, and there is no such thing, which means that the kind of self that we actually do have is totally relative, a nexus of interrelationships with everything else. And that being the case, then, once we realize our true relativity, so to speak, that we're totally interrelated, then that interrelationship has no limit. And so we're related to every other being. You know, no man is an island unto himself. You know, everyone is interconnected with everyone else. We're related to all other beings in the future. We're related to the past. And so we can find a point of familiarity and connectedness to everything and everyone. And this gives us tremendous spiritual energy and gives us the will to try to love everything and love everyone and be kind to them and not do anything negative, because we realize that even the slightest negative thing that we do will have an infinite negative consequence. And similarly, the most slightest positive thing we do, even a positive thought or attitude, will have a positive consequence. So therefore, we really take this moment seriously, because in this moment, we are accomplishing our whole future in a way. We're building our future drop by drop, so to speak, you know?
Yeah.
So selflessness is really means relativity rather than non-existence. It's sometimes misunderstood to mean somehow that the big deal is that you don't exist, but that would be really silly, and Buddha wasn't stupid, you know, because obviously we do exist. We're here, we are, you know. But the point is, we don't exist in some sort of absolute way, in the way we froze in some frozen, rigid, absolute way. We exist in a living, fluid, relative way. That's what our self is a living, fluid, relative self, and it's a work in progress, and it's something that we can create more and more, better and better, you know?
Yeah. So, in other words, we're working for connection. We're working for interconnectedness.
That's right. And we're working to be responsible for the connection, and so, therefore, we can't, we can't be irresponsible. You see, people who think that they're going to be exempt from the results of their actions simply because they die, they are being irresponsible and kidding themselves. And that's why, you know what I mean, the more you feel connected, the more you can be responsible to the moment. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it goes hand in hand, infinite life with infinite responsibility.
That's right. Yeah. Life is infinite responsibility, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, that would be really important. It would help people, you know, to help people to, get a step up to the plate and do things that are really necessary today to make peace on the planet, you know, to live at a more heroic level of virtue, you know, where they would be more proud of themselves, and to refrain from a little bit of consumption over here and there, and don't be quite too greedy about this and that, and make do with something a little longer, and give some gift to someone, and do this at a little more great level. You know, like 1,000 points of light, as the elder Bush used to say, you know, people themselves become a point of light in the world by feeling that infinite responsibility, or universal responsibility, as the Dalai Lama says. That would really, really be important.
Yeah.
And that's one of the main objectives of my book, is to open people of any religion, and of even and also humanists who are not of any particular religion, to open them more to this more level of heroic virtue, you know, to practice the virtues of generosity, patience, ethics, you know, creativity, concentration, and wisdom, and art, and really, really do these things in a way that the world needs them done today. Do you know what I mean? The world is in really, really serious shape, precisely because of people being irresponsible, not being accountable for their mistakes, not admitting their mistakes, stubbornly pushing ahead, or even misleading people about them. This is really very, very negative, and everyone has to be accountable and responsible.
Yeah. You know, there is so much noise in the world, and our minds can be very noisy places, too. What advice can you share that might help us to better focus our minds and our lives?
Well, that whole book is advice. The Infinite Life book is the best advice I can muster. But I think the most important thing I feel is to look critically at your view of reality. In other words, don't just accept on the basis of authority, either from scientific, so-called scientific authorities, or from religious authorities, that the world is this and this or that, and therefore you should obey this and this and that order. We should exercise our American right to free thinking and to free information, and we should investigate things and don't just accept on authority this and that, and then make our own judgments based on our investigation. And then when we do that, we will act much more sensibly. You know, people wouldn't just pollute and throw things in the river if they thought that their grandchildren were going to get poisoned or get birth deformities because of the things they threw in the river. They really wouldn't. So they need to, it's a better knowledge base, you know. And the worst thing that the worst thing I think that either the religious leaders or the scientific leaders will tell people is, it doesn't matter what you do. You know, it's all too important. The scientists say it's all accidental. It's all meaningless. There's no purpose to life. And you'll just be dead. And then when you're dead, you forgot about it. You never even knew you existed. So what you do ultimately won't matter. And the religious people sometimes say, oh, it doesn't matter what you do as long as you do it as a member of our church or our temple or our synagogue. If you get blessed by our God and you say, I believe in you, God, then you can do anything you want, be as greedy as you want, as violent as you want, it doesn't matter, because later someone else is going to clean up your mess. And either of these two types of worldviews, that reality views, which we, if we accept them on authority without fully properly examining them on our own good sense, then we are really letting ourselves in for living in the wrong way and not living well. And that's really my advice, is that have more confidence in your good common sense. Like I always tell people, when they go out to buy a vacuum cleaner, they buy 4 consumer guides, they test the vacuum cleaner, they look carefully at the different thing, they kick the vacuum cleaner at the Sears store. They may really investigate to make sure they get a good one. Why should you accept a version of life on the basis of just some guy in a white coat or some guy in a red cassock telling you it's like this or that because I say so or because somebody else said so? You should investigate your spiritual worldview with the same degree of common sense, bite the nickel and see if it's real, as you do your vacuum cleaner, because it's much more important to you than your vacuum cleaner. Your soul is a lot more important than your car or your vacuum cleaner, and you should look into it more carefully. So I'm trying to help people think more clearly and critically. You know, I am a professor. I can't help myself. And I want them to find things that they can use within whatever their sort of belief is to improve and open up their worldview so that they'll live better.
Let's talk with some more listeners. First, we're going to go to a caller in Rantoul on line 2, and then we'll take a call from a listener in Champaign on line 1.
Okay.
First to Rantoul. Good afternoon.
Hello, Professor Thurmond.
Hi.
I'm very much enjoying your show, and it inspired me to call you. My sister is an atheist, and I'm wondering if you can suggest a particular book or anything at all to convince her.
So your sister is what?
An atheist. And I'm wondering if you can recommend a book or anything to convince her of not a particular religion.
Some people become atheists because they're told by someone that God is like this and like that. You know, exactly, mm-hmm. We know, you know, because we have the sacred book or we have the one true statement, this kind of thing.
Right.
And it belongs to us, you know, it's our property. And we say it has to be like this, and then that version that they tell them doesn't make sense to them. So then they say, well, I don't believe in that, and then they feel they have to be an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Yes.
So the point is there should be a middle ground there. After all, you know, God, like, was a burning bush, a pillar of fire, or a big flood, a rainstorm. Nobody really knows. And God, I mean, human beings can speak 10 languages or 8 languages. Why would God only speak one language or write only one book or talk only to one person somewhere in a little corner of the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's absurd when people think. I call it conceptual idolatry, when people think that they have the one true thing that's just exactly that.
Right.
And therefore, if your sister realizes that life itself, is the wonder of life, the wonder of love,
mm-hmm.
the wonder of creativity and friendship and beauty, that these things are really what God might well be. You know, is this force of positive energy that sustains the universe, and it isn't exactly necessarily what the Buddhists say or what the Hindus or the Muslims or the Christians or the Jews say. it might be something even different than anybody thinks, because after all, the God in all of those versions is always telling people that they can't, they really won't be able to know exactly what it is.
Right, right.
But when they feel, when they're loving and kind and ethical, and when they're kind to their neighbor and generous, and love even your enemy, Jesus told people, then they're going to feel the presence of God. And so your sister might very well be a person. I'm sure she is, because you are a nice sister. You're listening to this program, and you're happy to talk about Buddhism. So she must be a nice person, and she is simply rebelling against a very strict, rigid version of what God is, mm-hmm. and therefore likes to say she's an atheist. But if she believes in life, she believes in her own value and her own life, then it would help her to get free, maybe, of the idea that if she should try to stop believing in nothing. That is to say, it doesn't make any sense to believe in, it makes just as little sense to believe in nothing awaiting you after death as it might to believe in a certain version of God awaiting you after death. And what she should really believe in is life itself, and she should realize she is an infinite being and has an infinite life, infinitely interconnected with her sister and with all of us, and that she can have her own version of God and be quite happy with it. And we will tolerate, we'll be happy with that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of way to approach it, rather than, oh, you're bad, or that's evil, or
right.
this and that, is to approach it to find a middle way between exactly some old gentleman sitting up there doing something in the sky versus no old gentleman, and then leave it at that. That's too simplistic on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for your answer. It gave me something to think about.
Read the book and get her to look into the book on the whole critique of the false reification of nothingness that the scientists promote. Then she might become critical of that side as well and find a more free position for herself in the middle.
I want to thank that listener for her call this afternoon. And let's take one more call, and we'll have to be brief here. I'm sorry.
All right, I'll try to be brief.
I'm sorry to say, because we don't have much time left here in this portion of the show.
I know, infinite life, our time is short.
Oh, the clock. It is always with us. Let's talk with us, caller, line one, Champagne.
Okay. Hi. You were talking about developing virtue, and I wondered, that seemed to go along with the Christian idea of works, or at least being a positive presence. And I was wondering if Buddhism had any idea similar to grace, although you seem to have talked against the idea of saving grace.
We do have an idea of grace, and we certainly, actually, you know the prodigal son parable?
Mm-hmm.
You can find that in a Buddhist sutra from 300 years before the time of the New Testament. And there was, in a way, a kind of common culture, and all of these great movements and these great teachers shared a common culture in some ways. We don't have to make such a huge difference between Buddhism and Christianity. And there is, of course, grace is enlightenment in the case of Buddhism, and it both comes from the blessing of enlightened, already enlightened beings, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and it also comes from your own insight and your own wisdom. So it's sort of combined, you and the divine beings. It isn't just the divine beings and you are nothing. But there is an idea of grace, absolutely. On the other hand, the negative deeds that one does are never kind of gotten rid of. They will always be there with harmfully. They might have harmed you. They might have harmed others. And you just have to become very, very enlightened to try to, like, overcome all of those negative causes, but eventually you can, and there is the kind of grace of nirvana, actually, I guess you could say. But on the other hand, the kind of way of interpreting things, and there also are Buddhist versions of that, that it doesn't matter what you do, that you can be nasty as you like and then just have a deathbed conversion and cry out for Jesus or Buddha, and then you'll be fine because they're just so great, it doesn't matter. In other words, they died for your sins, so go ahead and sin. You know, they died for future sins too, so you can go ahead and sin as much as you like, and then just later just go to the 700 Club or something and have a conversion and you'll be fine. And that kind of interpretation, we have that in, there are forms of Buddhism that are sold like that too, and those are considered very, very erroneous, because actually the more negative things, because look at it this way, grace of enlightened beings and grace of divine beings is with us all the time anyway and has been from the beginningless. The reason we don't appreciate it and don't enjoy it and we think we're lacking it, actually, is that we are behaving badly and our thoughts are bad and our deeds are bad. And so you have to clean up those deeds and thoughts Really, you do, and you can't just say, "Oh, that's just good works," and you shouldn't, and then that won't get you to heaven. It's just only God's grace. Ultimately, of course, God's grace is God's grace, or Buddha's blessing is Buddha's blessing. But you have to open and clean your own clock, so to speak, to be able to be open to it. And so that's why the ethical dimension is so, so important. I ran into a wonderful thing in the Gospel of Matthew the other day that I was looking at for various reasons and checking up actually on the rather sad Mel Gibson. And I was shocked to discover and delighted Jesus saying that he said, later in the future when I'm at the right hand of the Father, some people will come to me and say, "Lord, Lord, we did many great deeds in your name, deeds of power. Let us in." But I will say to them, "I don't know you. Take a hike. Go clean up your act first." And you know, that's the one who's supposed to save everybody from everything. But you can't. The point is, if we could just be saved by an outside power, they would have saved us all a long time ago. Universe would be over, end of story. Everybody would be blissful in heaven. Because they are omnipotent, they're omnicompassionate, they would do that. The whole point is, we have to make some contribution to it, and we do that through living well, through virtue, through love, through wisdom, through helping others, and therefore we're responsible for that.
There we have to leave it.
Okay, I'm sure I overshot the time. I'm sorry, Celeste.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Robert Thurman, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me on. And anytime you want to have me on again, I'm most happy to be there.
Terrific. Okay, well, let's do that.
Thanks.
In the meantime, listeners, you can look for Infinite Life, Seven Virtues for Living Well. The book is published by Riverhead Books.